Good afternoon, Juneau. It's a second or two before 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore here hosting today for Juneau Afternoon, and we have a great lineup of guests today. We're going to hear, first of all, in a few, about 5 minutes after National Native News, about the Wearable Art Extravaganza, which is coming up just right away. Jeremy Johnson will drop by. There's a series of classes starting out at the Hagavig Fire Training Center to form another community response team, community emergency response team. So we'll hear from Jeremy about those classes. Northern Light Church is going to be a busy place tonight. The Maria Offer is taking her yoga class. She normally teaches over at Rainforest on Saturday mornings, and she'll be coming in tonight to teach the kids from 6 to 7 p.m. at Northern Light United Church. And some of the cast from Annie will be showing up tonight. They're opening on Friday. Michaela Moore will bring some students over to talk to us. So all those things are going to be on today's show on Juneau Afternoon in just a few minutes. Right now it's time for National Native News.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The first lab report is in from the recovery of some Department of Defense barrels dumped into Lake Superior during the Cold War. Preliminary information says the barrels are not a threat to public health, but live explosives were found. Mike Simonson reports.
The report says, quote, preliminary data results show no immediate cause for concern regarding the safety of water and fish consumption, unquote. Frank Kane is a spokesman for the Red Cliff tribe, which raised the barrels.
There's nothing on the table that gives us any reason to believe there's anything to be concerned about right now. When we get the test results back and we find out what's there, then maybe that changes.
Although no radiation or harmful chemicals have been discovered so far, this three-page release says ground-up cluster bomb devices were found in the barrels. The report says they do know that the contents of those devices are explosive. Kane says that was one reason they raised only 25 barrels, is to err on the side of safety. So Kane says questions remain. They raised only 25 of the 1,400-plus barrels dumped by the Department of Defense into Lake Superior near Duluth between 1958 and 1962. Red Cliff had hoped to raise 70 for a more scientifically accurate assessment. Will more barrels be raised?
I guess until we have all of the facts in, I can't answer that.
Kane says more testing will be done by an independent laboratory before final conclusions are made.
No one's going to duck or hide or anything else from any of the findings because we want to know what is the best way to deal with the barrels.
Veolia of Neenah spent 2 weeks in August removing the barrels for Red Cliff. Funding for this six-year effort has reached $3.3 million from the Department of Defense. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson in Superior, Wisconsin.
The president of the United South and Eastern Tribes Organization, or USET, is urging tribal leaders to find a renewed sense of engagement when it comes to advancing Indian country issues. Leaders and members from more than two dozen tribes are meeting in Washington, D.C. this week. They're addressing priorities and concerns to move forward in Congress and with the Obama administration. Brian Patterson is president of USET.
We need to gather our best minds, the power of the good mind, to advance our own strategy. Congress is reacting in one direction, but that does not mean that we should be reactive from Indian country. And Indian country needs to become proactive with its agenda.
Patterson says some priorities include protecting women in Indian country, taxation, and land into trust. Participants in the Impact Week are also meeting with federal officials and members of Congress. The organization represents tribes from Texas to Florida up through Maine. The Navajo Nation is seeking funds for winter water problems. The tribe has started Operation Winter Freeze, which is estimated to cost nearly $3 million. The tribe's in a state of emergency due to frozen and broken water lines, leaving as many as 10,000 people without running water for nearly 2 months. According to the tribe, the funds would pay for additional work crews and costs of running its emergency operations center. The tribe's seeking state and federal assistance. In recent weeks, the tribe, located in the Four Corners region, has seen temperatures drop to minus 25 degrees. During this month in 2008, then Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd apologized to the country's Aboriginal people for past wrongs caused by the government. Aboriginal leaders have since called on the federal government to back the apology up with efforts to improve Indigenous communities. This week, an Aboriginal group has called on Prime Minister Julia Gillard to address the high incarceration rates of Aboriginal people and violence against Indigenous victims. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore hosting today. And the other host for at least 2 days a week for this show is going to take over the thing now. And,
yeah, what am I doing here?
I'm just going to leave.
What is going on? How did
Art Evans here, too. And they're both here to tell us about wearable art, which is imminent. It's imminenter and imminenter, as Alice said.
Mm-hmm. Right, Kari? I mean, it's like...
Yes, it's coming down to the wire now, for sure.
I hear the person, we're not ready.
No, we're fine.
Okay, so you're the director, and you said Kari was everything else.
Basically, yeah.
Kari, is that an official title?
I mean,
do we capitalize it when we put it up? Or,
production manager, sort of,
she's,
I think,
she's
along
a
with
coordinator.
Nancy.
Coordinator. I would
coordinator.
Say coordinator.
Coordinator.
And
yeah.
manager. But I'm sure Kari would be the first, and I would as well be the first to say that it all, this is such an incredible volunteer effort mm-hmm. that happens that brings us all together. It's absolutely amazing. Right now, we're just getting prepared. We just had a big technical meeting today, and we're getting prepared for the big build that's going to happen over in Centennial Hall, where almost unlike any other event, Centennial Hall gets utterly transformed for wearable art. And it's a big reason why I think a lot of people go, you know, just to see that room get transformed.
This is like, mm-hmm. I loved your phrase there, like no other event. I mean, this one is almost as unique as the Folk Fest.
It's, I think so, yeah.
We really kick it loose for this thing.
Mm-hmm. I think it's what it's...
Carpentry.
Engineering. Exactly. I mean, we're getting a load of plywood in tomorrow. You know, we're getting a load of lights in, or we're getting all that stuff. Everything starts getting built. And it's a 2-day build. It only, you know, all these great craftsmen and architects and designers only get 2 days to put this whole thing together.
Yeah.
And you know, it's incredible. And then you walk into that space, and everyone goes, "Wow!" You know, because it doesn't look like Centennial Hall anymore.
Yeah. There has been quite a bit of prep work done as well. Like Bing has been working on a centerpiece.
Bing.
To be discovered. Bing Carrillo is like a volunteer extraordinaire in town and for Juno Arts Council, and he's built this center piece that people will see when they come in Saturday.
He's an electrician by trade, and mm-hmm. so is really in charge of all the kind of, when there's ever a build that has to do with lighting and things like that, he takes control and of that part of it. And yeah, he's one of the extraordinary volunteers. Bower Clifton Interiors, Jeremy and Jason just devote hours and hours and hours of work in this. Sean from Northwind Architects, Sean Boiley.
Rick Pruitt.
Who is from KATH and is an amazing videographer. And so there's just all these different people. I mean, we're gonna leave out people's names here, but it's incredible to see the effort that goes into it. It's
so
really
that's
fun.
Just the building part of it, right?
Yeah.
So then we have all of the volunteers that are helping out on the show. That's maybe about 150 people or so. Front of the house, back in the house. Then we have all of the businesses that have donated to the silent auction. And remember, this is a fundraiser.
And you're doing, there's two separate silent auctions. They're unique, right?
Yeah, they're unique. And some businesses have donated two gift certificates, for example, like one for Saturday and one for Sunday. But there will be variations for the Saturday and the Sunday auction. But it's just incredible the amount of people, my spreadsheet of people who donated is like 150 businesses and private people long. It's so there's that part, and all the people that come to see the show and also spend a huge amount of money actually on those tickets to support for the Saturday show. I need to mention that the Saturday show funds go to Fine Arts Scholarship for Youth and individual artist grants. And then for the Sunday show, the proceeds go to the June Arts and Culture Center.
So that's the stuff that the JAHC is doing the rest of the year when they're not doing wearable art. You know, they're bringing great arts and culture into the community and then doing this really important work of fostering individual artists and grants for all the great, a lot of great work that happens in Juneau, and a lot of the artists that work and live in Juneau have benefited from that, those funds.
And actually, the scholarship applications for kids, I think it's 10 through 17 years old or so, or through a senior in high school. They can download the application now from our web and start applying, and then they will benefit from the money. Like, they will go through a audition process and hopefully be awarded money, and those money are from this particular event, the Wearable Arts Show.
And so those are like scholarships to like art schools?
It's for individual students who want to take classes, buy an instrument, travel to a workshop far away.
So it's not under the kind of constrictions that a scholarship for education is. You can use this for art if that's
supplies,
that's the design.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really exciting. And all the programs that JAHC does is really exciting, and a huge part of it gets funded out of this one event. It's really a big marquee event that happens.
I was going to say, all you have to do is work on one of these, and you know what one of those events costs.
Yeah.
I mean, bringing when we get somebody up on a stage in Juneau, there's a lot of money behind that.
That's
whole
right.
Thing.
Yeah.
And so this is what fuels those wonderful things that we get to see on.
Yeah, and there's a lot of individual costs for artists too. We have an artist coming in from Sitka, another coming in from Seattle. There's people that come in from all over. We've had people come in internationally. We've had people come in from Whitehorse before. Right? So it's been an international exhibition before.
Yeah, but it's international in another way. We've had a couple people place in this and then go on to win like a worldwide competition for wearable art.
Yeah, David Walker, who people know is doing this amazing, he's especially known for doing this amazing work in wood, you know, veneer and these thin woods. Has gone to the New Zealand, the WOW, I think it's called, right?
World of Wearable Arts.
World of Wearable Arts, and has won twice in two, and I think maybe two slightly different categories. I can't quite remember, but I think he won one, and he was on the front page of the Auckland News the next day. His picture and his work was on the front page, and it was big news there in New Zealand. So,
Lorelei Michael is participating with two pieces this year. She went there as well,
And she's a past winner of Wearable Arts in Juneau as well, Lorelei Michaels, and she has two pieces. Yeah, so it's really exciting to see all these different interpretations. You know, the theme this year is called organics, which is kind of an interesting term that that Clifton Bauer, Bauer and Clifton Interiors came up with. The idea being a mix between building block, organic building block materials, and a mechanic kind of element.
Mm-hmm.
And not every artist has to follow that, but a lot of them take that as a jumping off point for then kind of creating artwork. So that's been interesting to see how people take that term, whether they do it from a natural standpoint of an organic thing, or whether they do it from the standpoint of trying to mix those elements of mechanics and organic together. It's been really cool to see that stuff come together.
We're making this thing so wonderful, but the thing that people have got to know is that Sunday's gone, or Saturday's gone, right?
Yeah, it's sold out.
It's sold out. And Sunday, there's, 40 tickets
about
left?
About 40, last
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But we should let people know that 1 hour before the show, on both Saturday and Sunday, I think we'll sell out probably on both show before the event, we will start a wait list. So at 7 o'clock on Saturday and at 2 o'clock on Sunday, people can get on the wait list to get in the door.
But if you want to go...
Yeah, you need to buy a ticket.
Sunday night. And so the tickets are on sale all over. Well,
JAHC.org is an easy place to go online, and they're available, I think, at Hearthside and over at the JAC. Those are two easy places to go as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. you need to act now.
Act now, yes.
Absolutely.
Like, yes. In the next couple of minutes, it'll be gone.
That's it.
That's sort of true. We've been sort of ticking through the ticket count real quick. You know, dozens go a day, and the Saturday one's been sold out for a while. But, yeah, we hope to see everyone out there. We get over 1,600 people to this event, you know, in a weekend. It's an incredible event, really fun.
Wearable Arts, it's here.
It's upon us.
It is upon us, and everybody ought to get out there and buy a ticket that wants to go, because there just aren't that many left. Selection here by Jeff of appropriate to the theme, I guess.
Do you have a shirt that you really love? One that you feel so groovy in? You don't even mind if it starts to fray. That only makes it nicer still. I love my shirt. I love my shirt. My shirt is so comfortably lovely. I love my shirt. I love my shirt. My shirt is so comfortably lovely. Do you have some jeans that you really love? Ones that you feel so groovy in? You don't even mind if they start to fade. That only makes them nicer still. I love my jeans. I love my jeans. My jeans are so comfortably lovely. I love my jeans. I love my jeans. My jeans are so comfortably lovely. When I take them to the cleaners, I can't wait to get them home again. Yes, I take them to the cleaners. I'd rather wash them in a stream.
I'd rather wash them in a stream.
I'd rather wash them in a stream. Know what I mean? Do you have some shoes that you really love? Ones that you feel so flash in? You don't even mind if they start to get some holes in. That only makes them nicer still. I love my shoes. I love my shoes. My shoes are so comfortably lovely. I love my shoes. I love my shoes. My shoes are so comfortably lovely. I love my shoes. I love my shoes. In fact, I love my wardrobe. Oh, 1, 2, 3, 4. I love my shirt. I love my shirt. My shirt is so comfortably lovely. I love my shirt. I love my shirt. My shirt.
Well, if your shirt is made out of organics material, not organic, organics, then it's probably going to be walking across the runway at the Wearable Arts, which opens Saturday and plays Saturday and Sunday. Tickets are still on sale. They're still available for the Sunday performance that starts at 3 p.m., with the silent auction opening at 2, and when Kari was here a couple seconds ago, she said that an hour before each of the openings, they're going to start a listing. If somebody doesn't show up to use their ticket, they'll be reselling it. So there may be the possibility of getting in if you're really interested. So Wearable Arts this weekend here in Juneau. Amazing. This weekend. My next guest is Jeremy Johnson, and he is here to talk about a training session that comes up every once in a while around Juneau, and this one runs from now until March 2nd, I think, is the graduation ceremony, if you will. And this is training for forming a community emergency response team. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Pat.
So I had Tom Matisse on the show Friday. He was doing a talk up at the Glacier Visitor Center Friday night on the, I think they recentered it, and it was about the earthquake that had happened here just fairly recently. And Tom and I talked a little bit about our state of emergency preparedness in Juneau. And he talked about the fact that the fire department, the police department, the hospital, they're all ready. It exists there. So I guess the question is, and I don't mean to sound dumb, but why do we need a community emergency response team?
Well, to use the earthquake as the prime example, the Community Emergency Response Team is a citizen-driven initiative. So the citizens themselves are expected to attend to circumstances that only involve scenarios where the emergency system wouldn't be able to attend to them. So if we had an earthquake here in Juneau during avalanche season, then there's a potential for earthquake outcome, an avalanche outcome, and maybe bridge damage or something, which will very literally separate elements of the community from emergency response, especially if a bridge goes out or a road gets covered. And so the community initiative, the CERT team initiative, is to, give the skills to the people that would need to attend to their very local area. And the example of an earthquake would lead maybe an apartment building with some damage that, you know, you would want to account for your neighbors and make sure your neighbors are attended to. And then immediately after that, you would want to know who you could potentially turn to. And the CERT team is geared towards meeting that intermediary need. The number one thing that I make sure to address at the very beginning of the CERT training is our liabilities. We're technically protected under Good Samaritan, which means that we have to be trained to do a thing in order to do the thing. So someone shouldn't be doing first aid if they've not been trained to do it. Therefore, the Good Samaritan who's been trained in first aid can do first aid fairly. This is actually our second round in the last 12 months. So in 2012, we had our first round, which I want to say was October. I can't give you specific dates off the top of my head.
I had the guys on the show. I think it was over on Douglas Island, right? That was the center of it? No.
No, for the first...
Yes, he just lived on Douglas, the fellow that I interviewed. I can't remember who that was.
That may be the case. We're spread all over Juneau right now. The total number of people who have ever been CERT trained is much higher than the number who are currently active. The people that graduated from the most recent class, that was a set of 8 people, and they're in various locations. One's out North Douglas, one's on Douglas. I'm out Knock Bay, so, you know, there's definitely some downtown members. When anything that happens downtown, there's lots of coverage already with the emergency responders being physically present, geocentrically speaking, you know. But the elements that are CERT team trains for are very similar. For instance, building search and rescue, you know, that in that scenario we would say, is this building safe to enter? If the building's deemed safe to enter, we would go door by door for, you know, if it's a home, we go door by door, room by room. If it's an apartment building, we would go door by door and then room by room inside the apartment. Basically just noting that we had checked up on the people there. And if anyone's wounded, we tend to their primary care needs. And you got to remember that this is about triage and making it until the emergency medical services are able to show up. So, you know, under an ideal horrible circumstance, we would triage people to a safe location. If in this scenario I just mentioned a damaged building, you would move them to another safe building. If anyone is unable to be moved, we would note it as such. But we actually do practice safely removing people who are trapped, you know, say under a fallen beam or the recent cribbing that we did, which is to use pieces of wood to elevate objects. We did some cribbing exercise, which is an advanced part of the training. So we go through the search and rescue, we do first aid, we do triage, we do a little bit of how to psychologically deal with emergency situations. And then after the core certification is done, we do advanced training. Like this cribbing is advanced training. And I'm hoping to involve some more of the community programs that are already in place, you know, talking with Red Cross about what we can do with those folks to improve upon our existing training. Work pretty closely with Tom about trying to add more of those training opportunities. Fire suppression, I should also mention, we do basic fire suppression. Some people have just never squeezed an extinguisher, you know, and the first time you do that, it's kind of interesting, you know, to see the powder come flying out and all like that.
So and the nice thing is it's out at Hagevig Fire Training Center, so you have access to not only the equipment but a place that you can play with it.
Right, exactly.
And that's really good. I noticed I've got the ad from that announced this thing in front of me here, and there's 8 sessions, but 2 of them are like 5 and 6 are taught in just one night, and 3 and 4 are taught in one night. So there's really only 1, 2, 3, 4. 5, 6 meetings for the whole sequence.
Yeah, the way that I try to say it is 6 classes, 8 sessions.
Right.
So the first class, which is tonight, is introductory, the CERT basics, talking about liability, talking about what kind of instances we would be applicable for, some other local story kind of things we would talk about. I'm looking forward to talking about the Gastineau fire a little bit, maybe how we could have assisted with securing a perimeter or other pretty simple things for a major thing like that, which kept all of our core services very, very busy. You know, they had even people in from out of town to help with that scenario. The six classes are really about getting formal certification. So we have a trainer who is CERT training trained, right? And he trains. That's Mike Lopez.
That's him.
Yeah. And the university has Dan Garcia. He's allowed to train there. And so actually both of those fellas will hopefully be there tonight. And the CERT training, after the 6 classes are done, you get a certification. We give you a little printout that you can hang up or whatnot. And then we do competencies twice annually to build on those skills that already exist. We want to maintain those skills so that the certification is valid for effectively 3 years. And if you don't make any of the competencies, or you don't make our monthly meetings or the advanced trainings and that sort of thing, after 3 years, we would ask that you recertify. And for the most part, it's pretty straightforward. You know, the coursework is not very complex. You know, we talk about everything in class. The application of the coursework is the part that I think's the most interesting. Every class has an exercise. We do what we call a rodeo. We have 4 stations to go over the 4 core elements again: search and rescue, medical triage, first aid, and fire suppression. We do all those 4 elements during the exercise, and the exercise is the 6th class, session 8. And we'll have that happen twice a year, but on top of that, the city and the local geographic location does different scenarios every year. At the university, we did active shooter back in, I think, 07, 08, something like that. And we're looking at doing another scenario. I think it's airport is the next one, but that's not with the CERT. That's with the city proper. And then the state is doing Alaska Shield. So we're hoping to be a part of some of those grander events as we move forward, building our ranks and our popularity.
If someone wants to take this, there's no charge for the course, right?
Oh, no. It's sponsored by the city. The city provides the written resources. We provide a go bag for all of the students that complete the course. The go bag consists of triangular bandages, first aid kit, poncho, small heat blanket, you know, for in case of shock blankets. A helmet, a light, goggles, you know, those sorts of things.
So it's still possible, I don't know, is the class full?
No, the class isn't full. Right now we're setting a limit of 25 because it's the seating capacity. And off the top of my head, I believe that there are 15 or 13 registrants at present. Mm-hmm. And so there's still room for another 10 people if they show up.
So anyone who feels motivated to do this could actually do this. What would they need to do right away?
Oh, the thing that we've been asking is for people to register ahead of time. And you can get in touch with Mike Lopez or myself, which My phone number is 957-5368, and I want to say that Mike's is
7968989.
Yeah, you got me. And Mike has been the primary contact, and he's been having me, or I've been doing the administrative stuff for over a year now, I think, or about a year. And so with the two of us together, we're maintaining the coursework and stuff. However, if you've not registered before today, it's a little difficult to register, though the way that we bypass that is to say if you show up for class, then just go ahead and sign up now. We'll apply you as being registered and so on.
And there's still at least 10 slots that are available at the moment. So.
Right, and there will be another course. I can't tell you the start date, but it's October. I want to say the first week in October there will be another course coming through.
Okay. Okay, the Community Emergency Response Team training, Jeremy Johnson is the manager, I guess, administrator for the thing, and yeah, Mike Lopez will be running the classes. Those start tonight. They meet on tonight. They meet a week from Tuesday. They meet Saturday, the 16th of February, and then Tuesdays, the 19th and 26th, and then the last meeting is on March 2nd. So a total of six sessions that you need to go to in order to achieve the certification.
Yeah, that's four Tuesdays and every other Saturday.
Right, okay. Hey, thanks for telling us, and I hope people hear this in time to get signed up.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help! When I was young, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way.
The Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 5th of February 2013. It's the birthday of the cartoonist John Callahan, born in Portland, Oregon, 1951. He was adopted as an infant from an orphanage in Portland. Educated in Catholic schools, he was a rebellious kid. When he was 12, he stole a bottle of gin during his grandmother's wake and became a serious alcoholic as a teenager. When he was 21, he got drunk and accepted a ride from a drunk friend who crashed the car into a telephone pole at 90 miles an hour. Callahan's spine was severed, and he became a quadriplegic. That was in 1972. 6 years later, he said, "I knew with utter certainty that my problem was not quadriplegia, it was alcoholism." So he went to AA, he got sober, went back to school, Portland State, realized he had a talent for cartooning. And by the mid-1980s, he was nationally syndicated, a very controversial cartoonist. His targets included disabled people, politically incorrect, and many readers did not realize that Callahan himself was a quadriplegic. He drew a cartoon in which a sheriff's posse is standing around an empty wheelchair, and the caption, "Don't worry, he won't get far on foot." He drew an exercise class for quadriplegics, the aerobics instructor saying, "Okay, let's get those eyeballs moving." He did a cartoon entitled AA in LA, a man standing up and saying, "My name is Mort, and I represent Chuck, who's an alcoholic." Callahan published two autobiographies, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot, and Will the Real John Callahan Please Stand Up, died at the age of 59 from complications related to quadriplegia and respiratory problems. John Callahan, who said, "I'm happiest when I'm offensive. I have a desire to tear people in half. I want to move people out of the suburbs of their mind. I want them to suffer, to feel something real. I have a lot of anger. I want to hurt people, at least a little." It's the birthday of the actor and director-screenwriter Christopher Guest, born New York City, 1948, wrote musical parodies for the cast of National Lampoon, 1984 starred in a movie, This Is Spinal Tap, which got mediocre reviews when it came out, but went on to have a huge following. And from then on, Christopher Guest used the model that had worked so well for This Is Spinal Tap, a bare-bones screenplay that let the actors improvise their dialogue. And he directed Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and For Your Consideration. Christopher Guest, who said, "It's obviously inherently funnier to have, in a comedy, someone who isn't doing something very well." And it's the birthday of the playwright John Guare, born New York City, 1938, author of Musica, Landscape of the Body, The House of Blue Leaves, and 6 Degrees of Separation. Here's a poem for today by W.S. Merwin, entitled simply, Sonnet. Where it begins will remain a question for the time being, at least, which is to say, for this lifetime. And there is no other life that can be this one again, and where it goes after that, only one at a time is ever about to know, though we have it by heart as one, and though we remind each other on occasion. How often may the clarinet rehearse alone the one solo before the one time that is heard after all the others, telling the one thing that they all tell of. It is the sole performance of a life. Come back, I say to it, over the waters. A poem by W.S. Merwin's Sonnet from his collection Migration, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses improve their online reputation and reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 23 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. My next guest is Maria Offer, and Maria is going to offer a class tonight does every Tuesday night at Northern Lights United Church, and this is a class for yoga for children who are ages 7 to 13. Hi.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Yeah, so you also teach at Rainforest Yoga Center, I think.
Yes, that's correct, on Saturdays at 10:30 in the morning.
Yeah, for children as well.
Yes, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, is it?
It's great, yeah.
They aren't a discipline problem or anything?
No.
You don't have to keep them in line or anything. How do young kids relate to yoga? It seems to me it's kind of like a very serious undertaking.
Yeah, yoga for adults is quite different than yoga for children. Yoga for children is very engaging, and it's a lot of fun. It's more creative. We really tap into the children's creativity and play. You know, we play with yoga. And there's just, kids are just kind of a natural at it. It's a great exercise for body awareness, and they just have fun.
There are many yoga poses that have strange names, like the downward facing dog and the cat and cow pose and like that. And I'm thinking the kids probably have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, they do. And then we, with the very young children, like on my Saturday class is more geared toward younger children, and the children will do the animal noises while they're doing the poses. And it's very good developmentally.
I'm going to have to drop by.
Yeah.
Probably a screen. So, do you have to be aware of any dangers because of the children having such young bones? Is it possible for a child to like overstretch in a yoga class or something like that?
Well, yoga for kids is not real, an intense discipline, and it's like I said, play. So I'm not really teaching them poses. I'm showing them, and then they explore the poses. I have a background in doing safety training. I'm a former EMT for the state of Alaska, and I did a lot of first aid and safety training. So safety is my number one priority. I've done, you know, a lot of work in that, so I'm really aware of what things to do to be safe and, you know, make sure the kids are safe. And we set up certain guidelines. I have what I call, like, the yoga coloring book or yoga journal, and it's something they take home, and it has just kind of some basic principles of yoga, kind of boiled down in kid language, and then they can color or write about it. And so that kind of helps keep those principles in mind, you know, for the kids in between classes.
Do kids come to, like, multiple sessions, or do they come back?
Yes, and I offer punch cards, so people can parents can buy a card. So even if they miss one, let's say there's another activity going on, they can use their punch card and just come on the Saturdays or Tuesdays that they're available.
Mm-hmm. So you do this Saturday at the Rainforest and Tuesday night at Northern Light United.
Yes.
Okay. Is it really expensive or?
No, I think I try to keep it real affordable. It's $10 a class, mm-hmm. and then with the punch cards, it's less because it's like getting a free class for every punch card that families purchase. And then I offer family discounts. So if a family has, you know, two or three children, they'll have a discount. So that keeps it real affordable for families, too.
And you're actually donating the money that you're making on this to a cause, I think.
Yes, all the money I make besides paying rent for the space that I rent, I donate that toward a trip to Haiti with yoga kids. It's a program called Bridge of Diamonds.
Hmm. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, it's a really great program. I had been researching kids yoga online, and I found one of the best organizations nationwide was called Yoga Kids, and it was really started by some, you know, really knowledgeable people in working with kids' education. They have a program also called Tools for Schools, where they bring yoga into the schools and have a very organized curriculum for that. So I was very impressed with their program, and through that, I found they also had a program called Bridge of Diamonds. And there's a woman, she's a psychologist, and she organizes that. And they bring down teams of yoga teachers to, it's a town right outside of Port-au-Prince, and they have an area there where they give yoga classes to the kids. So the kids come in from the areas, like homeless areas, that they've been homeless since the earthquake. They just live under tarps. And so they come in, they get some water, a little snack, they do yoga, a reading lesson, and then after that they get a meal and an art project. So it really helps kids have fun, take a break from all their stress, and learn something fun.
Yeah.
As well as get some food.
And are you going to go down with you're taking some kids from here or not?
No.
Or is it just you?
Just myself.
Ah, okay.
I hope to go in the end of February.
Mm-hmm. How did you get into to teaching yoga to children?
Well, I'm a certified teacher. I'm a reading specialist. And I really, and even for my own life, I've really wanted a balance. And I've done yoga since I was in my 20s in Kodiak. I started doing yoga. Mm-hmm. And I did it my whole life, off and on. I had more time to do it. But as I got more into my studies and my work, I wanted a balance, and I got more into yoga to give that balance, some physical exercise that I can do. And I think also when I'm working with kids and we need a study break, we'll do some yoga poses, maybe tree pose, standing poses if we're in a classroom. And it gives a great break for kids, and they have fun with it. So it kind of helps balance the learning where we're just sitting with some physical movement. So it's a lot of fun.
The classic image of a yogi is someone doing an inverted pose. Do you teach the children inverted poses, like standing on their shoulders and on their heads?
In my Tuesday class, if the kids are interested in doing a little more advanced poses and ready, if I see they're ready, I have them work with a partner and teach them how to help each other in doing those poses. The kids love to do the back bend.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty flexible. But I give them some guidelines before they get into some of the more.
Yeah, there's actually
poses.
Some danger involved in those if you're not if you're not attended or trained.
Yeah.
So how big are your classes? How many students do you have?
Well, the space holds about 20, but I think optimal size for kids is about 12.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it varies week to week, you know, between five kids and up to, like I said, 12.
Do you want people to contact you before coming, or do they just show up at the door and bring their kid in?
Oh, it's always great when the families contact me ahead of time, but they're also welcome just to show up.
So if they want to contact you ahead of time and get on your registration and tell you that they're bringing their child, how would they do that?
By phone or email. I have posters around town that have my email on it and also my phone.
Okay. So this is Yoga for Children. Tonight's classes are ages 7 through 13, and the sessions are from 6 to 7 o'clock at the Northern Light Church. Maria Offer is the instructor. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Yeah.
On Monday, February 11th, Juno Jazz and Classics presents Jake Shimabukuro, ukulele playing like it's never been done here before. Compared to artists as wide-ranging as Jimi Hendrix to Miles Davis to Yo-Yo Ma, this concert is one you'll have to see and hear for yourself. So don't miss it, an unforgettable evening at the J.D. High Auditorium. More information and tickets at jazzandclassics.org, the Jack, Hearthside, and at the door. For the ukulele wizard, Jake Shimabukuro.
About 11 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you've just been listening to the music of Jake Shimabukuro. Isn't it amazing what that guy can do with a ukulele? There's some people in my studio who are doing an amazing thing as well. JDHS, with its ambitious theater program, amazing theater program. I've got half of the cast of Annie here. So let's see. We've got Cheyenne Silverly, who's playing Hannigan, right?
Yeah.
Hi. okay, and Ben Krall, the other, well, the bad guy, this is, you play Rooster, right?
Hello, is this thing on?
Yeah, it is. And Lily, Britta Fagerstrom is back. She was Friday, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were talking about something totally different. But anyway, we did mention this.
So good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. And Lily is with Rooster, and the two of them are evil.
Yes, very extraordinarily evil.
The person who is behind all of this stuff, who comes up with these crazy ideas, like somehow deciding that we should have a drama department that is so good that it should get nominated to go to the Fringe Festival. Michaela Moore is here, and are you directing this one?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Directing and producing.
Producing and directing both.
Yeah.
You don't have any spare time at all,
do
you?
I don't.
No,
sir.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really.
So this is a major undertaking.
Huh? Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is a full blown musical in two acts.
All
with
the way.
A bunch of great songs in it. I'm wondering. This was on stage back in the 80s. So
it's actually on Broadway right now.
Is it?
It reopened on Broadway as we speak, but we were able to keep our license, and so we get to continue on.
Cool. So the audience, is there may be people in the audience who have not experienced this particular little piece of stagecraft before.
That would be nice.
Yeah, I suspect so.
Nice.
I was thinking we could talk a little bit about the plot, but I'm not sure whether I want to do spoilers or not. Maybe we should just put out one of those things like you see on the internet that says spoiler alert, you don't have it flashed off.
Yeah.
But to kind of put things in perspective a little bit, that the plot it falls around a kind of a manufactured scenario that comes out of the Little Orphan Annie comic strip.
Yes, it does. Little Orphan Annie was a popular comic strip back during the Great Depression and World War II. And
Come on now, it appeared in papers up to the 50s and 60s because I used
did.
To read it.
It did. But that's when it got started, and that's where the musical takes place. It's from the 1930s, and everything's really symbolic for what the country was going through. That's why Daddy Warbucks' name is Warbucks, because everything in the comic strip is symbolic, and so the musical is extremely symbolic. It's mainly about an orphan who comes into the path of this very rich man, Daddy Warbucks, and how she affects him, and how because she affects him, he affects the president, and she affects the president, FDR. And in the musical, that's kind of where FDR gets his idea for the New Deal. But Little Orphan Annie is really us, our country. And I thought it was time to do this one again because our economy is kind of strained again, and people are losing jobs again and afraid and wondering what's going to happen. And I just think Annie is a very uplifting, hopeful musical.
Okay, so the whole thing takes place in and is set in the 1930s. So my question logically to you is, since that is so far in the past as to be probably in your minds mixed up with dinosaurs and things like that, how can you get your head around this, and how did you do it?
I think in general it's very interesting to do a different time period than, I mean, any modern theater. I think most things are set back, but it's interesting to try to think about what people would have felt at that time. I mean, our characters being the sleazy bums that we are, trying to just get this money out of this child, basically. We're trying to steal her away and get money. It's terrible. And trying to get your mindset around that but still make it very upbeat and light is interesting. But it's really fun, I think, to try to do that.
The place of an orphan in society has changed radically. Our view now of orphans is very different than it was in the 1930s.
Definitely.
The fact that this kid was, 10, 12 years old and still living in an orphanage, was a much more common circumstance in that period of time than it is today. And I'm curious. Anyway, I know who Rooster and I know who Lily are, but tell me about Hannigan.
So I'm playing Miss Hannigan, and she runs the orphanage.
She's not really...
And she's none too happy a person,
no,
I don't think.
No, yeah. She doesn't like the orphans that much, especially mm-hmm. Annie.
She's got a great song about children, right?
Yeah, 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 it's called Little Girls, and it's just basically about how much I really hate them. Yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah. I once had the wonderful experience of playing a bad guy in a play, mm-hmm. and I found an immense freedom in it.
Definitely.
Because
yeah.
It's probably no surprise to most of the people who know me that I'm not really a very evil person, but to be able to stand on the stage and run my thumb down a knife that I was about to stab somebody with was cool.
Yeah.
Well, it's awesome because when you do something like that, it's a character that's just nothing like you, and you get to, you know, that's why you love acting.
Yeah,
so you're not a con man under normal circumstances.
Well, I'm not saying I'm perfect, but I don't usually go in for killing and kids and stuff like that.
Well, good.
Yeah, good thing.
Nice to hear, Ben.
we're happy to hear that, Ben.
Yeah. I always say that villains are much more fun to play than leading roles. They add so much dynamic to any play, I mean, in any time period, any plot. I mean, they can be very very comedic villains, as ours are, and or they could be very serious villains that are very scary. But
they could be both.
Yeah. Very true. I think that ours are a nice blend of that, which is very fun. Yeah.
How many plays have you all been in?
Oh God.
What's the total number of
the last time I counted it was over 20, but
for you.
I've lost track.
I'm not sure how many total, but I think this is my sixth at JDHS. Yeah. I'm probably about the same. I've probably been about 20 just from all varieties of things for both of us. I mean, for all three of us, I mean, just being in, I mean, little children productions, high school, professional theater.
20, 46, and how about you?
Oh, my. 75.
So,
been a lot.
Among us here, we're somewhere in the 200s.
Yeah.
I'm thinking are the numbers that we're looking at here. Anyway, when you do this, do you find yourself taking somebody that you've seen and putting it into the role a little bit?
Sometimes.
Yeah?
One of my moves came directly from a guy who I saw do this in person in Star a few years ago. I changed it a little bit. I didn't quite steal his move.
Yeah.
But there's Tate Pollard, shout out. Yeah. Kid.
Uh-huh. Right.
I think it's very funny. This is my second time in Annie with the exact same character. I was in that production with Tate Pollard, and I've played this character before, and it's very fun to have different dynamics with these characters and the production. And, yeah, he's very true. It's we call it
It's the YFTM. It's short for the Wacky Inflatable Arm Flailing Tube Man. I named it myself, and that is an accurate representation of what I'm doing on stage.
Outstanding. Listen, we're real short on time. I need to say when this is going to be, right?
So it's this Friday, Saturday at 7 p.m. at JDHS, and then Sunday we're having a matinee that you can sing along to if you want to at 2 p.m., and then we do it again on the 22nd and the 23rd.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for alerting the audience to the
Thank
coming
you.
Of Annie.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. Some birds require habitats created by other animals. Two such landscape shapers were the American bison and the prairie dog. For thousands of years, these animals generated a mosaic of vegetation on the Great Plains, ranging from nearly bare earth in bison wallows and prairie dog towns to lightly grazed tall grasslands. Each benefited particular species of birds. With the extermination of millions of bison and prairie dogs, species such as burrowing owls that require barren ground greatly declined. The cattle that replace the bison and prairie dogs are also ecosystem engineers, but cattle, constrained by fences, graze nearly all areas quite heavily. Birds adapted to this degree of grazing live sustainably with cattle, but birds which prefer ungrazed or lightly grazed vegetation have become rare, such as chestnut-collared longspurs. The American Prairie Foundation is restoring a rich and varied prairie in northeastern Montana. They're removing fences and reintroducing bison to lands they've not occupied for more than a century. prairie dog colonies are also expanding. Ecosystems are resilient. By working with natural processes and employing the services of nature's ecosystem engineers, we can restore both birds and some of the lost grandeur of America's Serengeti. There's more to this story at birdnote.org.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska, 104.3 FM. We also broadcast in the area with a set of translators. 103.1 FM, K276AF, serves the Valley and Auk Bay. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269AWIT, 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, KTOO is on 89.9 on K210AS.